Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Genesis chapter 31, the last half of the chapter, verses 26 through 55. I'm going to call this audio Laban's Last Stand Against Jacob. Our context is this. In the first part of chapter 31, Jacob had fled from Laban because Laban kept hoodooing him, kept changing his wages, substituted Leah for Rachel, kept changing the deal about the sheep. Jacob says, give me the spotted sheep, and Laban says, okay, next year it's going to be striped sheep, and that kind of thing. He got tired of the trickery and the treachery, and so he packed up and left without telling Laban. And so Laban spends 7 days catching up with Jacob, and he catches up with him at Mizpah, which is across the Jabbok River in Gilead on the eastern side of the Jordan River, about two-thirds of the way down as you head from Galilee to the Dead Sea. So this is our context, and this is where we are. We start with verses 26, 27, and 28 of Genesis 31. Then Laban said to Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me and carrying away my daughters like captives of the sword? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me and did not tell me so that I might have sent you away with joy and with songs, with timbrel and with lyre, and did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters? Now you have done foolishly. Well, for Laban to tell Jacob, what have you done by deceiving me? Why did you flee secretly and deceive me? The word deceived is used twice in these first two verses, 26 and 27. And of course, that's Jacob's name. It means deceive. But I must say, Laban's got a lot of chutzpah talking about deceit. I mean, isn't he the one that sneaked his older daughter in place of the younger daughter that Jacob loved? And isn't he the one that kept changing the wages 10 times? Laban was a scoundrel and a cheat, and here he is pointing his finger at Jacob and saying, why did you deceive me? Well, that's typical. People who have their own sins typically point out the same sins in the case of other people. That's sort of human nature, and Laban did it. I wonder whether Laban was deliberately playing on Jacob's name. He might have been, might not have been, I don't know. But he, like I said, he still had a lot of gall to complain about Jacob's deceit. And he says, you took away my daughters, Jacob, like they were captives of the sword, like they were slaves taken as prisoners of war. Now, this is a complete overstatement. As John Gill says, the daughters left of their own free will. Jacob was not anywhere close to being a thief and a robber. He took nothing that did not belong to him. All those sheep that he had bred, the speckled and the spotted sheep, those were his, fair and square. Now, it is true that Laban's household gods were stolen by Rachel. But Jacob was unaware of that. He didn't know. So Jacob was feeling pretty innocent at this point and pretty ticked off. Well, Laban's ticked off first. We'll see Jacob being ticked off in the next couple of verses. Right now, it's Laban that's ticked off. And I say he doesn't have any right to be ticked off. Now, it is true his gods were stolen. So maybe that had something to do with his anger. But he didn't have any right to really complain about Jacob secretly deceiving him, because if Jacob had told Laban, Laban would have kept Jacob there, and Jacob never would have gotten back to the promised land with his beloved Rachel. It wouldn't have happened. And old Jacob wants to kiss his daughters, Jacob and Leah, like he's really done Jacob and Leah good by not giving them any inheritance and holding their husbands as slaves on the property almost, or at least against their will. Now, Laban didn't go so far as to accuse Jacob of being a thief, but Laban's sons did that in verse 1, remember? You've stolen everything from my father. That was in the last audio. But at any rate, all this pious talk is just that, pious talk on the part of Laban. He tells Jacob, I would have sent you away with joy and with songs. Timbrel means a tambourine. A lyre is like a cross between a guitar and a harp. I would have had musical instruments playing, and we would have had a great old party, and I would have been so joyous to send you away, and that's absolute baloney sausage. Laban wouldn't have sent Jacob away with joy. He probably would have tried to cut another labor contract with him and say, why don't you stay with me for another 6 years? And the very fact that Laban was chasing Jacob showed what his attitude was. Jacob said later on, he says, why have you come in hot pursuit of me, chasing him like he was a thief? So this is hypocrisy to the max. I would have sent you off with joy. Yeah, right. Genesis 31, verses 29 through 31. Laban continues, speaking to Jacob, it is in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. Now you have indeed gone away because you longed greatly for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Then Jacob replied to Laban, because I was afraid, for I thought that you would take your daughters from me by force. Now Laban starts out in verse 29 telling Jacob that it is in Laban's power, in my Laban's power, to do you, Jacob, harm. Laban's retinue was enough to take Jacob out, as John Gill points out. Laban, as we see in a previous verse in the last audio, Laban had come with his kinsmen chasing Jacob. So it was not just Laban. It was Laban and a whole posse. That means Laban could have stopped Jacob from leaving if he had known about the departure of Jacob. And that also shows Jacob's wisdom in secretly leaving, because Laban had the power to harm Jacob, and he would have. Now Laban says, "It is in my power to do you, Jacob, harm, but the God of your father, the God of your Jacob's father, spoke to me last night." Now, Laban doesn't say just God. He says the God of your father. That shows that Laban is still an idolater. Everybody's got their own personal gods, and God, Yahweh, was not Laban's God. He's still an idolater. And he says that this God of Jacob spoke to him last night, and this is Jacob's way of explaining to Jacob why Laban didn't take Jacob out. He says, "I've got the power to do you harm, and I could do it. I could do it right now, but I'm not going to, because I had a vision last night, or a dream last night, and your God said to not do you either good or bad. Don't speak good or bad to you." Now, good would be, "Hey, I'll give you another deal if you come back to Haran in Syria, and I won't do you any harm here in Gilead, where we are now. So come on back." Or bad was, "If you keep going, I'm going to wipe you out." Good or bad? And God says, "Don't you do either one of those. You let him go back to the promised land." And so that's what Laban intends to do, because apparently this dream shook him up a little bit, brought him up at least, say, "Ooh, I'm not going to mess with this God." Now, there's one thing that's confusing here. Verse 31, Jacob replied to Laban, "Because I was afraid." What was the question? "Why did you steal my gods?" Jacob replied, "Because I was afraid." Well, actually, that's confusing, because Jacob didn't know that the gods were stolen at this point. So what he's really answering is the question of, "Why did I leave secretly?" That's what he's saying. "You have indeed gone away because you long greatly for your father's house," Laban says. And Jacob is saying, "Yes, I did that because I was afraid. I was afraid you would take your daughters from me by force." He's not saying, "That's why I stole your gods," because he didn't know that the gods were stolen. Now, telling Laban that he was afraid, that was perfectly reasonable, given Laban's character and past conduct. Jacob was afraid. He was never in a position of strength there in Haran. He had a lot of sheep, but he didn't have any armed retinue to defend himself. I just watched a bunch of documentaries on World War II, and I kept thinking, all these moronic pacifist nations in Europe let Hitler run all over Europe, and they couldn't stop him because they weren't prepared. England, Czechoslovakia, Austria, Poland, they just got clobbered. And Hitler ended up killing 50 million people. If those nations had been prepared militarily, 50 million people would have been saved, because they would have said, "Okay, Hitler, cross the boundary lines, and we're going to take you out." But they didn't do it because they couldn't do it. Jacob didn't do anything to Laban because he couldn't do it. He was not militarily prepared. When I say militarily, of course, I mean he was not prepared with his own bodyguard and defense force, as small as that might be compared to an army, but it was still enough to protect him. He didn't have that kind of protection, so he was afraid. We go to verse 32. "The one with whom you find your God shall not live," Jacob continues talking to Laban here, and he makes a sort of a rash oath. "If somebody in here has got your gods, I'll kill him." Now, of course, Jacob just assumed that nobody would have stolen Laban's household gods. Who would have done something that crazy? Well, his own wife did. "Whoever finds your gods, the one with whom you find your God shall not live. In the presence of our kinsmen, point out what is yours among my belongings and take it for yourself." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them, and not stolen the household gods. "Now, in the presence of our kinsmen," the only kinsmen that are there really are Laban's kinsmen, who are also Jacob's kinsmen because he had married into the family. That's a little bit confusing when you see kinsmen, because all of Jacob's kinsmen were his four wives and his 11 children, who were boys, young boys. They're not really old enough to take part in this little drama. Now, the fact that Rachel had stolen those household gods without telling her husband, Jacob's wife, really put him in a bad position. Jacob had now been deceived by his own wife. So everywhere Jacob goes, there's deceit, either by him or to him. And Jacob almost lost the love of his life after struggling for 20 years to get her. Can you imagine what Laban would have done when he found out his daughter had stolen his household gods? Those household gods meant a lot to those ancient people. I don't think he would have killed his own daughter, but he probably would have taken her right back to Haran, and Jacob would have lost her. Now, this promise to kill whoever the gods were found with was a foolish and rash promise. Some people say that this is the reason that Rachel died in childbirth a few years later, as they, well, not a few years later, but a short while later, as they were leaving Haran, and they were going from Bethel down to Bethlehem. As they were crossing the Jerusalem area, she gave birth to Benjamin, and she died in childbirth, as we know in Genesis 35, famous story there. It's kind of sad. And some people say, well, she got what she deserved because she was put under a curse by Jacob, who said, you're not going to live if you stole the gods. Well, I don't believe that. John Gill agrees with me. He says this foolish and rash promise that Jacob made had absolutely nothing to do with Rachel dying in childbirth before her time. And I agree with that thoroughly. We go now to Genesis 31, verses 33 through 35. So Laban went into Jacob's tent and into Leah's tent and into the tent of the two maids, that's Bilhah and Zilpah. But he did not find them. He didn't find his household idols. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols and put them in the camel's saddle, and she sat on them. She probably did this while the search was going on in Jacob's tent and Leah's tent and Bilhah and Zilpah's tent. That's four tents. It gives them plenty of time to take the idols and put them on the camel and then climb up on the camel and sit on them. And Laban felt through all the tent, but did not find them. That's Rachel's tent. She, Rachel, said to her father, Laban, let not my Lord be angry that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is upon me. A very euphemistic way of saying, my period is upon me. And of course, a father's not going to tell a daughter to get up when she's got having her period, so he searched. He searched the tent, but he did not find the household idols because they were on the camels, being sat upon by his daughter Rachel. Now, Laban probably went into Jacob's tent first because Laban suspected Jacob most of all. That makes sense. And it's probably random that he went into Leah's and Bilhah and Zilpah's tent next, but it was fortunate because it gave Rachel time to put those household idols on the camel's saddle. Now, think about this. How disrespectful it is to sit on a god. Here those gods are that are supposed to give divination as to which way to go or protection or whatever it was that Rachel thought those gods were going to do. And now those poor idols have a woman's buttocks planted in their face. Yeah, well, that's pretty sad. And that doesn't speak too well of Rachel. Now, some people think she stole the gods just to spite her father, but that's petty. She probably thought those gods, those household gods, would have some power. So she's not exactly free of her idolatry yet either. Notice that when Rachel says, hey, it's my period, she deceived Laban, her father. So she's a deceiver too. Everybody's deceiving everybody in this story. Reminds me of when I was teaching college in China. I noticed that Chinese students were lying to everybody all the time. They'd lie to their parents, just bald-faced lies while I'm sitting there. They'd lie to their teachers. They'd lie to them. So I was told a class one time, I said, now maybe this is a cultural thing, I don't know, but everywhere I turn, Chinese people are lying to one another. They lie to their parents. They lie to their boyfriends. They lie to their girlfriends. So this young student, girl student, she raises her hand and she says, I don't believe that's true. I never lied to my boyfriend. And I looked at her, I said, but you're lying to me now. And everybody laughed because they knew it was true. Everybody's lying to everybody all the time. Well, that's not the kind of atmosphere you want. You want people to be more or less truth tellers. I mean, sometimes if, you know, the woman asks you, oh, do I look pretty? And you say, yes. You know, I don't know what I think about that. I mean, it's just, you can't be brutally honest all the time. But, you know, 99.9% of the time you ought to tell the truth. And this was not going on here. Now, notice that although Laban searched for the idols in the tents of the party, he never searched the flocks, Jacob's flocks, to look for solid black goats and solid white sheep, which would have belonged to Laban. He must have trusted Jacob's integrity on that deal, because Jacob had been working with him for 20 years. He probably knew the man was honest as the day is long. We go to Genesis 31, 36 through 37. Now it's Jacob's time to get angry. Then Jacob became angry and contended with Laban. And Jacob said to Laban, what is my transgression? What is my sin that you have hotly pursued me? Though you have felt through all my goods, what have you found of all your household goods? Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen, that they may decide between us too. He was angry, and justifiably so, in my humble opinion. Laban had done him dirty for 20 years, and now he's getting mad because Jacob leaving? Come on. Now, we got a problem here with this kinsmen thing. Set it here before my kinsmen and your kinsmen. That sounds like Jacob had some kinsmen, and Laban had some kinsmen, and it was a fair arbitration panel, and we'll decide who's right and who's wrong. The problem with that is that who were Jacob's kinsmen? All he's got with him is women and children. His oldest kid, Reuben, is probably only about 6 years old or so, or 12 years old. I don't know. Who knows exactly? But he's a little kid. What other adult males were there? There weren't any. So when he says my kinsman and your kinsman, he means Laban's kinsmen, who are also his kinsmen because he married into the family. We go now to Genesis 31, verses 38 and 39. Jacob continues, "These 20 years I have been with you, Laban. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried." A ewe is a female lamb, female sheep. "Have not miscarried, nor have I eaten the rams of your flocks." A ram was a male sheep. "That which was torn of beast I did not bring to you. I bore the loss of it myself. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night." Now, 20 years since Jacob first arrived in Haran to try to get Rachel, and many people calculate 77 years when he arrived to see Laban. So that would make Jacob 97 years old now. But I must say this is not a precise date, this 77. A lot of Ishmael and Isaac and Abraham's and Sarah's ages can be determined with precision, but not Jacob. It involves a lot of assumptions. Adam Clark says there are insoluble chronological problems coming up with that 77 number, so I don't know how old he was. But at any rate, however old he was, he spent 20 years with Laban. And he says, "During that time, your female goats have not miscarried." He mentions the females first. Female goats, and of course, I'm assuming he means the female sheep too. He just puts goats in place of both goats and sheep. "They have not miscarried." This is no doubt due to the blessing of God, but it also could be that Jacob is taking credit for this because he's a good shepherd. He knows how to herd sheep well so that they don't miscarry. Feed them right, take care of them right. I'm not a shepherd, so I don't know, but I'm assuming that that's what he's referring to, his good care of the sheep, and of course, God's providence. And he says, "Nor have I eaten the rams of your flock." Now, this would have been tempting to eat the males. You're not going to eat the females because they bear sheep, and that would be stupid. But now the rams, meat. Back then, they didn't have a lot of meat. With no meat, shepherds had to eat soup and lentils and that kind of stuff. Meat, that would be tempting, especially if it's not your ram, it's Laban's ram. I'd be tempted to eat it. But he says, "No, I didn't eat it." Now, in verse 39, he says, "I did not bring that which was torn of beasts." Let's say a wolf attacked the sheep, ripped up the sheep, killed it. And so, according to custom and law back then, and also later in the book of the law of Moses, the law was the sheep owner had to bear the loss, not the shepherd. But Jacob says, "I bore the loss of it. I didn't make you," which according to law, Laban, you should have borne the loss of this sheep, but I bore the loss. Now, apparently, Jacob and Laban had not put a risk of loss provision in the contract, which is generally a good contract will have that. That wasn't in there, and barring a provision, the law would have said, or custom, which was the law, would have said that the sheep owner takes the loss. The sheep owner is the bailor in legal terms, and the shepherd is the bailee. The bailor is somebody who turns goods over for safe care, and the bailee is the person who takes the goods to take care of the goods. So I'm going to use those terms now. Please excuse me, but that's just the quickest way to do it. So Jacob is the bailee, shouldn't have had to pay. Now, under the later law, and under Moses, we see this, Exodus 22, 10 through 11. If a man gives his neighbor a donkey, an ox, a sheep, or any animal to keep for him, and it dies, or is hurt, or is driven away while no one is looking, an oath before the Lord shall be made by the two of them that he has not laid hands on his neighbor's property, and its owner shall accept it, and he shall not make restitution. Means he, the bailee, shall not make restitution. And that was and Adam Clark said that was likely the law that was in force at the time of Jacob and Laban, even though they weren't under the Mosaic law. So, in other words, Jacob went above and beyond the call of duty by taking the loss of those sheep. He did the same thing about whether the sheep was stolen by day or stolen by night. Generally, the shepherd, the bailor, took the loss, not the bailee, the shepherd. But in this case, Jacob said, "I, the shepherd, will take the loss." Did take the loss. I didn't make you bear the loss yourself. Now, the next question is, well, how did Jacob bear the loss? How did he pay Laban back? He had no wages. He was keeping somebody else's flock. So how could he pay Laban back for the sheep that was torn by a wild beast or for the sheep that was stolen? Well, here's some options on how he could have made the loss good. It could be that Laban had given Jacob some perquisites, some perks, maybe some few sheep on the side so he could eat and have a stew every now and then. It's just not mentioned in the text, but the overall flock would belong to Laban, but there'd be a little tip, if you will, a little perquisite of a couple of sheep. That makes sense. Or it could be Jacob might have obligated himself to make it good in the future. Says, okay, the sheep got torn by a wild beast. It got stolen. I'll pay you back later when I have some sheep of my own. So we go down to Genesis 31, verses 40 through 42. Thus I was, this is Jacob still speaking to Laban, thus I was, by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night. That's great English. That's a lousy translation in my opinion. But anyway, thus, this is the New American Standard Bible, thus I was, colon, by day the heat consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep fled from my eyes. These 20 years I have been in your house. I served you 14 years for your 2 daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you changed my wages 10 times. If the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had not been for me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the toil of my hands, so he rendered judgment last night. Okay, Jacob is unwinding now. He's ventilating big time. Jameson, Fowson, and Brown say perhaps the release of his pent-up anger helped him reconcile with Laban. They ended up making a treaty with each other. So maybe getting it off his chest might have helped him. Might be the same's true with Laban getting it off of his chest. I don't know about that. I think the main thing is not psychological here, but it's that dream that Laban had that said that don't you do anything to Jacob. Don't you say anything good to get him to come back or anything bad to threaten him from leaving. Leave him alone. Let him go. Now, Jacob says he's by day the heat consumed me and the frost by night. A couple of options of what that means. Jameson, Fawcett, Brown says it refers to the extreme differences in temperature between day and night which occur in the desert, and I believe that's what he's talking about. John Gill says, well, it might be he's talking about by day in the summertime the heat consumed me and the frost by night in the wintertime consumed me, but I don't think that's what it is. I just think it's deserts can get real cold at night. And he said, my sleep fled before my eyes. Sometimes shepherds had to watch their flocks by night. Now, actually, that wasn't the usual practice, but sometimes flocks would have to be watched at night if some of them were giving birth, if there were predators around, and so they would have to stay up all night with the sheep. We recall in the Christmas story, Luke 2:8, in the same region there were some shepherds staying out in the fields and keeping watch over their flock by night. So sometimes they would. Shepherds would hang around at night. And of course, if you're doing it at night, you're not sleeping, so sleep would be said to flee from Jacob's eyes. Now, Jacob complains to Laban here that Laban has changed Jacob's wages 10 times. We've already discussed this in a previous audio, as mentioned earlier, but this could be metaphorical. In other words, a whole bunch of times, or it could be literal. You changed my wages actually 10 times, and this is the way that would work. Oh, so this year I'm supposed to give you spotted sheep. Well, next year, since you got so many spotted sheep this year, Jacob, next year it's going to be striped sheep. Oh, got a lot of striped sheep here. Next year, this coming, the new year, you got a lot of striped sheep. We're going to change your wages again, and we're going to have speckled sheep, you know, that kind of thing. Or it could just mean 10 means you change, every time I turn around, you're changing my wages. Now, verse 42, Jacob says, if God hadn't been with me, you would have sent me away empty-handed. And that's true. If he had told Laban, hey, I want to go home. Laban said, fine, but I'm keeping all the sheep. He might have said, I'm keeping your daughter, my daughters too. Just get out of here. Jacob had good reason to fear this crook Laban. Now, Jacob says that the God of my father, who was Isaac, the God of my father Isaac is Yahweh, and the God of Abraham who's Yahweh. And then he says, and the fear of Isaac. So it's not only the God of Isaac, but the fear of Isaac. Well, what does that mean? It means the God who Isaac fears, the fear of Isaac. And some translations, the NIV, for example, capitalizes the fear of Isaac. The fear of Isaac, the one whom Jacob fears, the divine being whom Jacob fears. The NIV Study Bible says that fear is a surrogate for God. The fear of God is the God of Isaac. And this term is going to come up again here in this passage. It's a little strange, the fear of Isaac. God is referred to as a fear, and that means a reverential fear, of course, not a servile fear. Some commentator, whose name I didn't write down, unfortunately, says the Hebrew here might mean kinsman, so instead of the fear of Isaac, it's the kinsman of Isaac, stressing the intimacy of God's relationship to the patriarch. I don't know about that. We'll just take it as the fear of Isaac. Now, here's what Clark says about that strange word, fear of Isaac. Quote, it is strange that Jacob should say, the God of Abraham and the fear of Isaac, capital F, when both words are meant of the same being. The reason perhaps was this. Abraham was long since dead, and God was his unalienable portion forever. Isaac was yet alive in a state of probation, living in the fear of God, not exempt from the danger of falling. Therefore, God is said to be his fear, not only the object of his religious worship in a general way, but that holy and just God before whom he was still working out his salvation with fear and trembling, fear lest he should fall, and trembling lest he should offend. Okay, that's a sort of a long rabbit trail about the fear of Isaac. One other point about verse 42 here. Laban says that he, God, rendered judgment last night. Well, how did God render judgment last night? Well, Laban is referring to his dream, where God said, don't you say anything good or bad to Jacob. We read about that in verse 29. I'll read it again. It is in my power to do you harm, Laban says to Jacob. But the God of your father, the God of your Jacob's father, spoke to me last night, saying, be careful not to speak either good or bad to Jacob. So God intervened here and saved Jacob's life. One more example of how God providentially works out what he wants to work out without violating anybody's free will. We go to Genesis 31:43-44. Then Laban replied to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters, and the children are my children, and the flocks are my flocks, and all that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? So now come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me. Now Laban replied to Jacob, but he didn't confess to Jacob. He didn't ask Jacob for forgiveness. He just says, in fact, he does even more than that. He's trying to justify himself. Hey, these daughters are my daughters, not yours, not your wives, but my daughters. The children are my children, i.e. his grandchildren. Not yours, Jacob. You're the father, but I'm the grandfather. The flocks are my flocks. Oh, really? I think they were Jacob's flocks because Jacob earned those speckled and spotted goats and sheep. Fair and square, according to contract. So Laban, when he says they're my flocks, he might have meant they came from my flocks, as did the children, and as did the daughters for that matter. And all that you see is mine. In other words, everything you got here is because of me, Jacob. Everything you got here is because of your uncle Laban's efforts and possessions. Arrogant son of a gun, was he not? He says children, but the Hebrew word for children can mean grandchildren. So, you know, that's a common occurrence in the scriptures. And then Laban says to Jacob, but what can I do this day to these my daughters and to their children whom they have borne? In other words, hey, I can't hurt you, Jacob, by hurting your wives, because that would be hurting my own daughters and my own grandkids. I can't do anything to you. So let's make a deal. Let's make a covenant. Well, he basically points out that he wants to make a deal with Jacob because of constraints. There's nothing else he can do. He can't hurt himself by hurting Jacob. He then brags to Jacob that everything Jacob's got really came from Laban. And I think this proves that Laban is pretty much of a greedy, sniveling hypocrite. He's not a nice guy. We go to Genesis 31:45-47. Then Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Jacob said to his kinsmen, gather stones. So they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there by the heap. Now Laban called it Jegar Sahudutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. Now the pillar was set up. This is a memorial of the covenant that was about to take place there. That was a commonplace practice in the ancient Near East. And sometimes they would anoint the pillar with oil. We saw that when Jacob set up a pillar at Bethel on the way when he had the vision of Jacob's ladder, the dream of Jacob's ladder. It says, Jacob said to his kinsmen, that's not his sons because they're too young. But John Gill says it could refer to his servants. Well, it doesn't say servants. The King James says my brethren, which could refer to servants. Maybe the translation is loose enough to call the kinsmen servants. But I think it's easier to say, as John Gill does, he's referring to Laban's kinsmen, because Laban's kinsmen were also Jacob's kinsmen, because Jacob had married into the family. So Jacob said to Laban's kinsmen, set up some stones here. Now, why were there some other stones besides the pillar stone? John Gill says those other stones were made into a table on which they ate their food. In fact, the King James says, let's eat here upon the heap of stones. The NASB has, they ate there by the heap. I think the King James makes a little more sense there. Why would you eat by the heap of stones if you're setting it up? Unless those stones were made just for an altar. They could have been both for a table and an altar, or in the alternative, for an altar. Clark says it was both, a double purpose, a table and an altar. Minor detail there. The point is that they ate together. Covenants often ended with a shared meal, signifying a bond of friendship, as the NIV Study Bible says, and John Gill say. Now, the name of this pile of stone, this memorial pillar, along with its heap of stones, by the heap of stones could have been used as part of the memorial as well as the pillar, and it could have been used as a table. I'm going to assume it's used for memorial, at least for that, maybe for both eating and for the memorial, but at least for a memorial as well as the pillar. So this heap of stones was given a name, and the part of Laban, Laban called it Jigar Sahadutha, which means a heap of witness, as Gil says in the Syriac and Chaldee language. Now, I was curious, I know what Syriac is, it's a version of Aramaic, and Aramaic's a dialect of Hebrew. I didn't know what Chaldee was, I looked it up on Wikipedia. The Chaldean language is Chaldean Neo-Aramaic, or simply Chaldean, is a northeastern Neo-Aramaic language spoken through a large region stretching from the Nineveh Plains in northern Iraq together with the parts of southeastern Turkey. Well, southeastern Turkey is right next to Syria, and so that's what Laban was probably speaking. Chaldee, a form of Aramaic, which is a form of Hebrew, and of course, and the Holman Christian Study Bible note actually says that Jigar Sahadutha is an Aramaic, roughly speaking, Aramaic, which is a dialect of Hebrew. So that would explain how they could converse together in different languages. And it also explains why they would give the heap of stones a different name. Now, this brings up a related question. How could Jacob and Laban converse with each other since they spoke different language? Well, remember, Jacob had spent 20 years in Syria. That's plenty long enough to learn the language. And plus, the languages were dialects of each other. In a previous audio, I told about my experience talking to a taxi driver in China, in Yichuan, out in the western part of China. And I was trying to get him, tell him how to get me home. And I kept saying, I can't understand this guy. My Chinese is so bad that he can't understand me and I can't understand him. So I would slow down and explain it to him and I'd catch some of his words. And finally, I found out later, says, oh, the taxi drivers around here don't speak Mandarin. I was speaking the local Yichuan dialect. I said, well, that's great. I just commuted to talk to somebody in a dialect that I had never heard of before, and he understood me. I mean, it was hard, but he understood me, and I understood him. So I know Jacob and Laban could talk to each other, especially after 20 years. To show how close the languages were, Laban, who was a Syrian speaking Chaldean or Chaldean Neo-Aramaic, speaking that, he used a Hebrew word to name the memorial, Mizpah, as we'll see in the next verse. So the languages are close enough together where there's not a communication problem. Now, Jacob called the heap of stones Galeed. Remember, Jigar Sahadutha in Aramaic means a heap of witness, and Galeed means a heap of witness in Hebrew. It's the same meaning, it's just different languages. Gil and the NIV Study Bible say Galeed means a heap of witness. That's a pun on Gilead in Hebrew. Gilead means hill of testimony, according to Easton's. So heap of witness, hill of testimony, that's pretty close. And even transliterated in English is close, Gilead and Galeed. But anyway, this is how Gilead got its name, I'm pretty sure. I think that's true. So this memorial here, Jigar Sahadutha and Galeed, this is the famous, where the famous Mizpah benediction was spoken. So let's look at that. Genesis 31, 48 through 50. Laban said, this heap is a witness between you and me this day. Between you, Jacob, and me, Laban, this day. Therefore, it was named Galeed, which means heap of witness, and Mizpah, which means watchtower, and Mizpah, for he said, may the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. This is Laban speaking. He named it Mizpah, which means watchtower, and then he says the famous benediction that is said at the end. Just last Sunday, the brother who was closing the service said this exactly the same way. May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from the other. But that completely takes the so-called Mizpah benediction out of context. This was not a benediction. This was a curse. As the NIV Study Bible says, what Laban is saying is, God's going to watch you, and if you mistreat my daughters or do something that I don't like, if you take some extra wives and mistreat my daughters, God's going to watch you, and he's going to get you for that. That's far from a benediction. Now, where is this Mizpah? Well, if you look at Gilead, remember Gilead is to the east of the Jordan River from the southern tip of the Sea of Galilee to the northern tip of the Dead Sea. And if you go about two-thirds of the way down that stretch between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea in the valley there, the Jordan Valley, about two-thirds of the way down, there's a river that runs in from the east into the Jordan River, and that's called the Jabbok River. Now, according to my map on BibleAtlas.org, and it doesn't have a question mark, so I'm sure they know where it goes. If you cross that Jabbok River, just go a little bit, cross it, and a little bit east of the mountains there, which are separate the Jordan Valley from the desert there, right across the Jabbok River, and to the east of those mountains is Mizpah. And so he's getting a good ways on his way down to Beersheba. He'll have to cross the Jordan River, then go down a little bit, you know, to the very far south, southern tip of the Dead Sea, or southern portion of the Dead Sea, and then halfway to the Mediterranean before he got to Beersheba. But he was on his way. Well, I just love it when I think about all the mythology that's in the scripture. The Mizpah benediction, it was a curse. That just is one more example of how tradition interferes with our understanding of scripture. Read the Bible. Don't just let somebody tell you something. Now, what was God supposed to look out for? If you, Jacob, mistreat my daughters, Laban's daughters, i.e. Jacob and Leah, God's going to get you for that. Although no man is with us. See, God is witness between you and me. In other words, I won't be able to see you mistreating my daughters, but God can see it, and he'll take care of you. Another thing that God is supposed to look out for is if Jacob takes wives besides his daughters. Now, this is interesting. What's wrong with taking another wife? Polygamy was accepted back then. Well, the reason Laban wouldn't like it is because that would decrease the patrimony, the inheritance of Rachel and Leah. If you took 10 wives, now you got to divide the patrimony up between all those women. Well, the next question I ask is, well, so what? Doesn't Jacob have the right to do that? Well, apparently, or maybe this is my speculation, I didn't read this in a commentary, my speculation is that that was part of the deal that they made there in this covenant at Mizpah. It was at Mizpah, where the heap of stones called Gilead was. This was the deal that Laban is saying. I will sign this covenant with you if you promise not to take any more wives. I suspect that's what's happened. We go now to Genesis 31:51-53. Laban said to Jacob, "Behold this heap, and behold the pillar which I have set between you and me. This heap is a witness, and the pillar is a witness, that I will not pass by this heap to you for harm, and you will not pass by this heap and this pillar to me for harm." Now notice there's a heap and a pillar. I didn't really emphasize that enough, I don't think, before. The pillar is the memorial stone, and the heap of stones, which is probably an altar where they burnt animals on it. It could have been used for a table to eat on. But there's two things, the heap of stones and the pillar. Verse 53, "The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us." So Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Now, when Laban says, "Let no one pass by the heap for harm," there's some options as to what he could have meant. He could have meant the stones are boundary markers between our lands. NIV Study Bible suggests that. But the problem is Laban didn't own land all the way down there past the Jabbok River. He was way up to the north and east in Syria. And likewise, Jacob didn't own land all that far from Beersheba. He was way to the north and east of Beersheba. So I don't think it's boundary markers between people's lands. Another option is that if either one of those parties to the covenant, if either one of them just passed that memorial, they would be violating a treaty, and it would be considered a hostile act. But it could be that what Laban is saying, you could pass the memorial all right, Jacob, as long as you don't come with the intent to do harm. But if you pass that memorial, that pile of stones, that pillar, with the intent to do me harm, then you've broken the covenant. And likewise, if I pass the pillar and heap of stones to do harm, then I've broken the covenant. And I suspect that's what the correct option is, the last one. Now we have sort of a difficult problem of translation here in verse 53. Most of the translations do it like the NASB does it. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the God of their father, judge between us. Now, what's the problem here? The God of Abraham, well, that's Yahweh. The God of Nahor, Abraham's younger brother, capital G, God of Nahor, is that Yahweh? Nahor was a pagan. He didn't believe in Yahweh. And then it says the God of their father. Well, Nahor and Abraham's father was Terah, and we know he was a pagan, but the translation has capital G God for Nahor and capital G God for the father Terah. So that's a monumental problem if you ask me. So here's the solution that I came up with using Ellicott's commentary. First of all, the judge is plural. So it should read the gods of Abraham and Nahor. Not only judges is plural, but gods is plural too, Elohim. So it would read like this. The gods of Abraham and Nahor judge between us. the gods of Abraham and Nahor, came from the gods of Terah, the father. Now, to translate that plural is no problem because El is singular and Elohim is plural and Elohim is in the text. The NIV says you possibly should translate this as gods, which would reflect Laban's polytheistic background. John Gill agrees with the NIV study Bible, so we're going to think that's good authority. We're going to translate it as gods. So let's read it again. Verse 53, Genesis 31. The God of Abraham and the gods of Nahor, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, the gods of their father, judge between us. And the way Ellicott interprets that is by saying, apparently Laban thought that Abraham took one of Terah's gods and Nahor took another one of Terah's Elohim gods. And so it would read like this. The God of Abraham, one of the pagan gods of his father Terah, and the God of Nahor, the pagan god that came from Terah, Nahor's father, and the god of the gods of their father Terah, judge between us. Let me say that again. The God of Abraham and the God of Nahor, who are the gods of their father Terah. In other words, Laban thought that Abraham had one god of his father Terah, and Nahor, Abraham's younger brother, had another god of Terah. So all of them make up the set of the gods of their father, Terah. So in other words, that's not Yahweh. It's not Yahweh in the text. 53, the God of Abraham, meaning a pagan God of Abraham and the pagan God of Nahor, who were the pagan gods of their father, Terah, judge between us. So Laban is actually not appealing to Yahweh. He's appealing to pagan gods. So Jacob swore by the fear of his father, Isaac. There's that phrase again, fear. By the way, that neat solution by Ellicott to the who these gods are and how can these gods refer to Yahweh when Nahor and Terah are pagans, the Amplified halfway solves the problem. I couldn't find any other translation that were translated with little g gods. But the Amplified says in Genesis 31:53, the God of Abraham and the God of Nahor and the little g god of their father Terah judge between us. So they handled Terah as having a little g god, but they got the God of Nahor as capital G, meaning the true God. Maybe they thought Nahor got converted somehow, but if he did, I don't know how they know that, how the translators of the Amplified know that Nahor got saved. Maybe they just assume that. It's a relatively minor point, but it's kind of interesting. We go now to Genesis 31:54-55. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his kinsmen to the meal, and they ate the meal and spent the night on the mountain. Early in the morning, Laban arose and kissed his sons and his daughters and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. So they made a sacrifice on the mountain. Of course, the sacrifice was an important part of the covenant ceremony. As you know, you cut the animals in half and walk between the pieces. The covenant meal was also an important part of a covenant ceremony. They didn't always have meals, but they often did. They ate the meal, spent the night. Oh, and it was kinsmen who ate the meal with Jacob. And again, that's Laban's kinsmen also, as well as Jacob's, because Jacob married into the family. This meal, of course, has already been referred to. We've already mentioned it back in verse 46. And Jacob said to his relatives, his kinsmen, gather stones, and they took stones and made a mound and ate there by the mound. So that's the same meal they're talking about. They spent the night on the mountain. They had a whole day to get this Mizpah ceremony taken care of, this covenant at Gilead. They had to negotiate. They had to prepare the meal. They had to celebrate the covenant. It took a whole day. Then they rested that night. Now Laban kissed his sons and his daughters. Now his sons, who were they? Well, Jacob was one, his son-in-law at least, but he's probably talking about Laban's grandsons because, again, father and sons can sometimes mean ancestors or descendants, not necessarily the immediate ancestor or immediate descendant. So his sons would probably refer to his grandsons and his daughters. That would be Jacob and Leah, maybe Dinah, his granddaughter. It was Leah that was Dinah's mother. And he blessed them. Laban came with the intention to harm Jacob, but he left by blessing Jacob and his family. And Adam Clark says this, God has turned a curse into a blessing, which happens a lot, folks, with God and the providence of God. He's a good God to do things like that. Then Laban departed and returned to his place, no more to be heard of in the biblical record, returned to Haran in Syria. Ladies and gentlemen, with that, we have finished Genesis chapter 31. Verses 26 through 55. In our next audio, we will begin chapter 32. We will do verses 1 through 21. We will see Jacob preparing to meet his brother Esau. Remember, Esau ran him out 20 years earlier because Esau was threatened to kill Jacob, and Jacob had to leave Beersheba to go to Haran. So we'll see what happens as Jacob prepares to meet his fate in our next audio. I hope very much that you enjoyed this one.